Welcome to Learning English from the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver. Our 30-minute program of news and features is designed for people learning English. So we speak slower than normal, using simple sentences and a limited vocabulary. Today, we hear stories from Kelly Jean Kelly, Ashley Thompson, and me. We also hear a short segment of What It Takes, a podcast from the American Academy of Achievement. And we close the show with an American story. Today, we listen to part 4 of The Blue Hotel by Stephen Crane. Here is Kelly Jean Kelly.
The Supreme Court of the United States ended its term this month with a striking, almost dramatic finish. In recent days, the court announced major decisions that relate to immigration, labor unions, and a woman's right to end her pregnancy. It also ruled on tensions between gay rights and opponents of same-sex marriage. Then, one of the 9 justices, Anthony Kennedy, announced he is retiring. Kennedy is 81 years old and the second oldest person on the high court. Some court watchers call him the swing voter because they have a hard time predicting how he will vote in cases. His decision to retire and the person who replaces him will affect Supreme Court decisions far into the future. In the U.S., the president nominates someone to fill an open seat on the 9-member court. Then a Senate committee holds hearings on the nomination. If committee members vote to approve the nomination goes to the full Senate. Once approved, Supreme Court justices can serve in the position for the rest of their lives. Kennedy's retirement gives President Donald Trump the chance to nominate someone who is likely to appeal to members of his Republican Party. Trump nominated such a candidate in 2017, following the death of Justice Antonin Scalia in early 2016. Scalia died during the presidency of Barack Obama, a Democrat. Although Obama was president at the time, Republican leaders in Congress refused to hold hearings on the person he nominated. Now, however, a top Republican lawmaker said the Senate stands ready to move quickly on hearings for Kennedy's replacement. The importance of who sits on the Supreme Court has been clear in recent decisions. A narrow majority of 5 justices, including Kennedy, ruled that Trump's travel ban on people from some majority Muslim nations is legal. The same narrow majority struck down a rule requiring all public workers to give financial support to labor unions. In another decision, 5 members of the court ruled that crisis pregnancy centers did not have to tell women the state offered free and legal abortion services. And a larger 7-2 majority ruled in the case of a Christian baker in Colorado. They said he did not violate the law by refusing to make a wedding cake for a same-sex couple. Kennedy added that state officials had not treated the baker's religious objections respectfully. Supreme Court justices aim to be independent interpreters of the Constitution and not politicians. However, a reporter for the Associated Press notes that Americans who approve of the recent Supreme Court decisions may also support Trump and other Republican candidates in the next elections. Reporter Jonathan Lemire noted they may do so in order to ensure another conservative-minded justice is added to the court. Lemire noted that Trump himself took the unusual step of publicly releasing a list of Supreme Court candidates, most of whom were traditional jurists that many Republicans believed would uphold conservative values. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
Route 66, a town square in Colorado, and hurricane-damaged sites in the Caribbean are among America's most endangered historic places. The National Trust for Historic Preservation recently released its endangered list for 2018. The list includes architectural and cultural sites the nonprofit group considers at risk from development or lack of care. Places named on the list sometimes end up receiving greater support and money for repairs. But other times, a listing can lead to debates about public spending. Saving historic places is costly. Officials and the public may feel that developing the area would bring much-needed modernization or economic growth. The National Trust has identified nearly 300 endangered historic places since 1988. Fewer than 5% of those listed have been lost, the group says. Here are the 11 sites identified in the latest endangered places list.
Route 66 represents America's love of the open road. American lawmakers have taken a first step to protect the road by proposing it be named a National Historic Trail. The move would bring recognition and economic development to historic sites along Route 66. But first, the U.S. Senate must pass legislation, and the president must sign it by the end of 2018. If the measure does not pass, the National Trust warns a vital preservation opportunity may be lost.
The Trust says Larimer Square is the most historic part of Denver, Colorado. It also was the city's first business center. The area has for years been considered a good example of how to revitalize neighborhoods through preservation, the group adds. However, development proposals and building projects threaten the famous square.
The 2017 hurricane season brought death and destruction to the Caribbean, including Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands. The storms also badly damaged many historic and cultural areas. The 2018 hurricane season has already begun, and the damage remains. The Trust says these sites are further threatened because of limited materials, financing, and preservation expertise.
The walkout schools in Los Angeles were central to the 1968 East LA Chicano student walkouts. The protests were part of the nationwide Chicano, or Mexican-American, civil rights movement. The five middle and high schools are physical representations of the power of student activism, the Trust says. But it warns they are under threat. School district officials are calling for their demolition.
The city of Annapolis, Maryland, sits on the Chesapeake Bay. Annapolis is the state capital and home to the U.S. Naval Academy. Its city dock area is one of the most historic spaces among U.S. cities. However, a proposal to change rules on land use threatens the city's quality of life, tourism economy, and views of the Chesapeake, the National Trust says.
The Ashley River Historic District is in the South Carolina Lowcountry, near the city of Charleston. The Ashley and nearby rivers were important for early settlers and transportation in the Lowcountry. The historic district includes sites connected to the area's rice-growing culture and timber industry of the late 19th century. The National Trust says the area is threatened by a proposal that would lead to changes and intensive development that could damage the historic landscape.
The Wallace E. Pratt House, also known as the Ship on the Desert, sits within the Guadalupe Mountains National Park in Texas. The house was the home of scientist Wallace Pratt. It was built in the modern international style of architecture that rose to popularity beginning in the 1920s. In the past, the National Park Service gave tours of the property and let its workers stay there. Today, the home is closed to the public and badly in need of repairs.
The Mary and Eliza Freeman houses are said to be the oldest houses built by African Americans in the state of Connecticut. They are the final remaining structures of the Little Liberia community of free people of color in the North before America's Civil War. The National Trust says the houses have been empty for many years and need extensive repairs.
The Susan LaFleche Picotte Memorial Hospital in Nebraska is named after the first Native American to receive permission to practice medicine in the U.S. It is believed to be the first medical center built on Indian land without federal money. Today, the hospital is empty, and the National Trust says it faces an unsure future.
Mound Bayou in the Mississippi River Delta was one of the first all-black towns in post-Civil War America. A former slave, Isaiah T. Montgomery, set up the town. His home still stands today, but it is said to be in great need of repair work to prevent it from collapsing.
The trust also notes a proposal to build a gas processing station close to Piscataway Park. The park sits on the Maryland side of the Potomac River, across from Mount Vernon, the home of George Washington, America's first president. The project would affect the famous view from Mount Vernon and surrounding land.
My life has always been like sitting on the banks of a river and watching the world go by. Because I was so fortunate that the first thing that I can remember was that my mother and father loved me.
That's Bill Russell, arguably the greatest basketball player of all time.
And the one thing that my folks told me among all things, do not be afraid. Every obstacle that you encounter, all it does is present another opportunity. Like my father told me when I was 4 years old, he said, say you decide to be a ditch digger. Most people don't think of that as a noble profession, quite accurately. But if you decide to be a ditch digger in this small town in Louisiana, I want people in Miami, New York, D.C., Chicago, San Francisco to all say, there's this guy in Louisiana digging ditches. You have got to go down and see these ditches he's digging.
Well, when Bill Russell grew up, people in Miami, New York, D.C., Chicago, San Francisco, and a whole lot of other places did know his name and did rush to see him. Not digging ditches, of course, but outrunning every man on the basketball court, dunking and blocking shots. Bill Russell led the Boston Celtics to 11 NBA championships in 13 years, an insane run between 1957 and 1969.
You can listen to the whole podcast on our website, learningenglish.voanews.com.
The Blue Hotel, Part 4.
The Swede's face, fresh from Johnny's blows, felt more pleasure than pain in the wind and the whipping snow. A number of square shapes appeared before him, and he recognized them as the houses of the town. He traveled along a street until he found a saloon. He pushed open the door and entered. At the end of the room, four men sat drinking at a table. The Swede dropped his bag upon the floor and, smiling at the saloon keeper, said,
"Give me some whiskey, will you?"
The man placed a bottle, a whiskey glass, and a glass of ice-filled water upon a table. The Swede poured himself an extra large amount of whiskey and drank it down.
"Bad night,"
remarked the saloon keeper, without interest. He was acting as though he were not noticing the man, but it could have been seen that he was secretly studying the remains of blood on the Swede's face.
"Bad night,"
he said again.
"Oh, it's good enough for me,"
replied the Swede as he poured himself some more whiskey.
"No,"
continued the Swede,
"this isn't too bad weather. It's good enough for me."
The large drinks of whiskey made the Swede's eyes watery, and he breathed a little heavier.
"Well, I guess I'll take another drink,"
said the Swede after a while.
"Would you like something?"
"No, thanks. I'm not drinking. How did you hurt your face?"
The Swede immediately began to talk loudly.
"Oh, in a fight. I beat the soul out of a man at Scully's Hotel."
This caught the interest of the four men at the table.
"Who was it?"
asked one.
"Johnny Scully, son of the man who owns the hotel. He will be nearly dead for some weeks, I can tell you. I beat him well, I did. He couldn't get up. They had to carry him into the house. Have a drink."
Instantly, the men, in a quiet way, surrounded themselves in privacy.
"No, thanks,"
said one. It was a strange group. Two were well-known local businessmen. One was a lawyer, and one was a gambler. But a close look at the group would not have enabled an observer to pick the gambler from the other men. He was, in fact, so delicate in manner and so careful with whom he gambled that the men of the town completely trusted and admired him. His business was regarded with fear and lack of respect. That is why, without doubt, his quiet dignity shone brightly above the quiet dignity of men who might be merely hat makers or builders or salesmen. Beyond an occasional unwise traveler who came by rail, this gambler supposedly cheated only careless farmers who, when rich with good crops, drove into town full of foolish pride. Hearing at times of such a farmer, the important men of Romper usually laughed at his losses. And if they thought of the gambler at all, it was with a kind of pride of knowing he would never dare to attack their wisdom and courage. Besides, it was known that this gambler had a wife and two children in a nice little house, where he led a perfect home life. And when anyone even suggested that there was a fault in his character, the men immediately described the virtues of his family life. And one must not forget to declare the bare fact of his entire position in Romper. It is true that in all affairs other than his business, this card player was so generous, so fair, so good, that he could be considered to have a higher moral sense than 9/10 of the citizens of Romper. And so it happened that he was seated in this saloon with two local businessmen and the lawyer. The Swede continued to drink whiskey and to try to make the saloon keeper drink with him.
Come on. Have a drink. Come on. No? Well, have a little one then. By God, I've beaten a man tonight. And I beat him good, too. Gentlemen,
the Swede cried to the men at the table,
have a drink?
Shh, quiet,
said the saloon keeper. The group at the table, although really interested, had been trying to appear busy and talk. But now a man lifted his eyes towards the Swede and said shortly,
thanks. We don't want any more.
At this reply, the Swede straightened.
Well,
he shouted,
it seems I can't get anybody to drink with me. I want someone to drink with me now. Now! Do you understand?
He struck the table with his hand. Years of experience had hardened the saloon keeper. He merely answered,
I hear you.
Well,
cried the Swede,
listen then. See those men over there? Well, they're going to drink with me, and don't you forget it. Now you watch.
Stop that,
shouted the saloon keeper.
Why should I?
Demanded the Swede. He walked to the men's table and by chance laid his hand on the shoulder of the gambler.
What about it?
He asked angrily.
I asked you to drink with me.
The gambler simply turned his head and spoke over his shoulder.
My friend, I don't know you.
Never mind,
answered the Swede.
Come and have a drink.
Now, my boy,
advised the gambler kindly,
take your hand off my shoulder and go away.
He was a little, thin man, and it seemed strange to hear him use this tone to the big Swede. The other men at the table said nothing.
What? You won't drink with me, you little fool? I'll make you, then. I'll make you.
The Swede had grasped the gambler fiercely at the throat and was dragging him from his chair. The other men jumped up. The saloon keeper ran toward the table. There was a great scene of shouts and movements, and then a long knife appeared in the hand of the gambler. It shot forward, and a human body was cut as easily as if it had been a piece of fruit. The Swede fell with a cry of greatest surprise. The businessman and the lawyer must have rushed out of the place backward. The saloon keeper found himself hanging weakly to the arm of a chair and gazing into the eyes of a murderer.
Henry,
said the latter,
you tell them where to find me. I'll be home waiting.
Then he left. A moment afterward, the saloon keeper was in the street, racing through the storm for help and, more important, companionship. Months later, the cowboy was cooking meat on the stove of a small cattle farm near the Dakota border when there was the sound of a horse stopping outside. The Easterner entered with mail and newspapers.
Well,
said the Easterner at once,
the fellow who killed the Swede will spend 3 years in prison. That's not much, is it?
He will? 3 years?
The cowboy turned the meat in the pan.
3 years? That isn't much. No,
replied the Easterner.
There was a lot of sympathy for him in Romper.
If the saloon keeper had been any good,
said the cowboy thoughtfully,
he would have gone in and hit that Swede on the head with a bottle in the beginning of it. That would have stopped all this murdering.
Yes, 1,000 things might have happened,
said the Easterner sharply. The cowboy moved his pan of meat on the fire, continued with his philosophy.
It's strange, isn't it? If he hadn't said Johnny was cheating, he'd be alive this minute. He was an awful fool. I believe he was crazy.
I feel sorry for that gambler,
said the Easterner.
So do I,
said the cowboy.
He doesn't deserve 3 years in prison for killing that fellow.
The Swede might not have been killed if everything had been honest.
Might not have been killed,
exclaimed the cowboy.
Everything honest? When he said that Johnny was cheating and acted so crazy, and then in the saloon he practically asked to get hurt?
With these arguments, the cowboy made the Easterner angry.
You're a fool,
cried the Easterner fiercely.
You're a bigger fool than that Swede. Now let me tell you one thing. Let me tell you one thing. Listen. Johnny was cheating. Johnny,
said the cowboy blankly. There was a minute of silence, and then he said strongly,
oh, no. The game was only for fun. Fun or not,
said the Easterner.
Johnny was cheating. I saw him. I know it. I saw him. And I refused to stand up and be a man. I let the Swede fight alone, and you were simply jumping around the place and wanting to fight. And old Scully, too. We are all in it. This poor gambler just got pulled into it. Every sin is the result of shared effort. We, 5 of us, have shared in the murder of this Swede. You, I, Johnny, old Scully, and that fool of an unfortunate gambler came merely at the end of a human movement and gets all the punishment.
The cowboy, hurt and angry, cried out blindly into this mystery of thought.
Well, I didn't do anything, did I?
That's all the time we have today, but we'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place. For VOA Learning English, I'm Katie Weaver. Thanks for listening.